It is not news to any of us that this world is filled with evil and suffering. If God exists, why is there evil? It is a perennial question asked by believers and unbelievers alike. How can we explain it? From where did evil come? How is evil actually an argument for God's existence? How do skeptics and atheists define evil? Does evolution explain it? How do Christians define it? Does the Bible tell us everything about it? In his latest book, Outgrowing God, atheist and Oxford evolutionary biologist Dr. Richard Dawkins doesn't much address the problem of evil. Instead, toward the end of a chapter about moral philosophy, he suggests rather simply that, quote, "the great spy camera in the sky is surely not a praiseworthy reason to be good. So perhaps we should all give up the idea that we need God in order to be good." The great spy camera in the sky is to be read as God's omniscience and omnipresence. But why, then, should we be good, according to Dr. Dawkins? What is moral goodness on a purely evolutionary scale? In the opening of the chapter on moral philosophy, he claims that we are just like all the other animals in that, quote, "we humans are the product of hundreds of millions of years of evolution. Brains evolve like all other parts of the body, and that means that what we do, what we like doing, what feels right or wrong, also evolve," end quote. Dawkins notes in passing that, quote, "the evolutionary reason to be nice is hard to explain," end quote. But in a later chapter concludes that, quote, "there does indeed seem to be some Darwinian pressure to be nice, which could serve as the original basis for our sense of right and wrong," end quote. But even if evolution bequeathed to us a moral sense, as Dawkins suggests, that does not make moral behavior binding upon any of us, any more than a biological impulse to eat demands that we do so, or a feeling of anger commands us to give into it. There is no moral oughtness coming from natural selection. But when you do introduce the concept of good and evil into the universe, as C.S. Lewis notes, quote, "you are putting into the universe a third thing in addition to the two powers, some law or standard or rule of good, which one of the powers conforms to and the other fails to conform to. But since the two powers are judged by this standard, then this standard, or the being who made the standard, is farther back and higher up than either of them, and he will be the real God," end quote. Evolution is thus insufficient as a foundation for definitions of good and evil. One, because, if true, it is in our genetics and not transcendent enough to judge between two competing moral agents. Second, at best, evolution only gives us a feeling for what we prefer, a disparate and confusing amalgam of likes and dislikes, not anything that morally obligates us to the pursuit of truth and goodness and loving our neighbor. Nature will certainly kill us, but it will not, nor can it, hold us morally accountable for our behavior. The cosmos, by itself, doesn't care what we do. On part two of our conversation with Dr. W. David Beck about the history of philosophical questions about God's existence, we unpack how evil serves as an argument in favor of God's existence, as well as discuss how we can practically apply these philosophical questions to our daily lives and witness. As we begin part two, Dr. Beck suggests that the famous 18th century skeptic David Hume actually gives us a few good reasons for believing God exists. Dr. David Beck.
I mean, it's horrible to have to say this, but there's an incredible amount of intelligent design that went into the Holocaust. It wasn't an accident, and I think Hume is quite right. He gives us the only argument I know of for the reality of Satan, that there has to be an intelligent source for the evil that occurs in this world. So here's another one. Hume mentions that, or Philo mentions, that the universe, the design of the universe, is pervaded by this maleness and femaleness. So God himself must be. Well, you know, that's an interesting sort of objection. It's precisely what Christians and Jews have always held, that God is in that sense beyond gender, but beyond in the sense that he incorporates both male and female characteristics. We forget the female characteristics of God, that God is a mother hen who protects her chicks. There are lots of female analogies for God. Hume has lots of good and interesting objections, but in the end, they don't really do anything to the argument, except to make us a little cautious about the conclusions we draw simply from this argument.
Right. So it's part of a cumulative case.
Right.
I know sometimes
right.
it's presented as a knockdown case, but it's only a percentage of a much larger and broader perspective where
right.
I've talked to a lot of skeptics who like to isolate the arguments, think they've defeated it, and therefore now what are you going to do? Not looking at it holistically. As did the ancients. This was a holistic argument. These were natural philosophers. These were people that were versed in mathematics and science and literature and art. And so their thinking and conceptually, contextually, was much more rich, I think, than our own. But Hume does, as you say, he provides a good philosophical context for the reality of evil, which we just had a discussion with Dr. Michael Roos and Dr. Paul Copan about evil in our book club. And so, you know, we were talking about, you know, design and purpose in the universe and things. And of course, Dr. Roos goes right to the problem of evil. And that became sort of the discussion. But that brings up the third argument for God's existence, which is quite powerful. The idea of morals, morality, the idea of good and evil, the idea of this oughtness, this intrinsic sense that we, as you mentioned, C.S. Lewis, we know we ought to behave. We communicate with one another as though we have moral expectations that the other person will understand and comply with. And so, you know, as God, when God created the universe, he finished everything and he said, it's all very good. There's a goodness in the teleology. There's a goodness in creation that is impacted by evil. But that, as you say in your chapter, with several good examples, evil is there, but it requires a foundation of goodness in order to be valid. So the problem of evil seems to be much more of a problem for the skeptic who wants to utilize it as an argument against God's existence. Would you say that would be a fair representation of the back and forth on this particular argument?
Yes, I think that's quite true. I know of at least three philosophers who were atheists. Not all of them have come to Christ. Two of them have. But they have been converted, so to speak, from their atheism precisely by the occurrence of some really tragic evil event in their lives, because they couldn't handle the reality of this tragedy without admitting the full reality of evil, and they had no way to define evil apart from an objective good. And once you see that, you're halfway there on the moral argument.
It's powerful. I mean, it's. I think you mentioned Anthony Flew in the book.
Yes,
who didn't fully capitulate to Christianity, but through his examination of teleology, I believe you said it was, there's an entire moral argument behind what we've just been talking about. There's undergirding purpose and design is good and evil. And so it's hard to make sense of evil. How do you see, in your experience and research, how do you see, you know, the skeptic philosophers sort of defining evil? You go into it a little bit in your book. How do those that rely upon the argument from evil, how are they objectifying their definitions of evil? What is the standard by which they are making this assessment? Is it just sort of an outward looking at human behavior, or is it something intrinsically abstract? How do they justify their use of the word and definition of the word.
Well, there are some interesting things that are going on in philosophy. It will be really interesting, I think, to watch the next 20, 30 years. It's kind of become impossible, I think, to common sense, to deny the objectivity of evil. The old argument that was so prevalent back in the 50s and 60s, even into the 70s, 80s, that evil and good are simply subjective terms, that, you know, in the wake of 9/11 and all of the horrible things that we've seen, I think maybe in part too, because of all of the work that has been done on the Holocaust and World War II, we had almost forgotten about World War II, but you know, in recent years, it has become a great interest. There's a great deal that's been written about it, including the Holocaust. And when you see those kinds of evils face to face, it really becomes impossible to say that this is just my subjective reaction. That my being horrified at the Holocaust or 9/11 or the Boston Massacre or whatever, that's simply a matter of feeling. That just doesn't work. But to answer your question, the current attempts to handle this have been to say that somehow this objectivity is simply evolution at work, that what we recognize is that there is a kind of basic counter to human life that's built in to the evolutionary process. We used to think that evolution was Mother Nature that was nourishing and, you know, was on our side, but now it's become clear that Mother Nature is not on our side. And so if that's true, where do we really get these ideas that they're simply the product of evolution giving us certain intuitions about what is good for us and what is not? That's the current attempt, but it won't in the end give us some sort of objectivity.
Yeah, it seems to be if we grant natural selection and a morality and a construct of morality coming from a purely naturalistic worldview, the best we have with a system of morals and ethics is a disparate amalgam of likes and dislikes. Right. I'm offended by that. I don't like that. But there's no oughtness coming from my disdain of cheese, right? I don't like cheese, but that's not going to prevent anyone. Doesn't turn into a don't eat cheese. That's just, I don't like cheese. And that seems to be the most powerful thing I've seen, is that we have a system of agreement where I have five people over and five people, four people, they don't like the cheese. And somehow that turns into don't eat the cheese for the one person who disagrees with them. But that you don't get the oughtness out of that. There's this moral obligation. Something has to be greater than my repulsion at it. Because as you've noted, the atrocities that litter the landscape of our history suggest there have been large groups of people who don't think there's anything wrong with slaughtering other people or, you know, whatever tragedy that you wish to invoke. Right. So it has to be something deeper than I don't like that. But that, as you say in the book, it seems to be that seems to be the strongest impulse that we have in the philosophical literature. Obviously, we all don't like that. So obviously, it's just a brute fact that we don't like it. Therefore, but it doesn't translate that a moral brute fact, if that's what they want to do, makes it a binding moral imperative on anybody.
Right. Yeah, I think the key word here is the word obligation. Think about all of the allegations lately, many of them proven, about sexual harassment or even rape, notice that we just can't lay them aside by saying, well, oh, that's just the way men are, right? That's the way evolution has made us. And suppose I were to say to these women, well, you're feeling abused by so-and-so is just the way evolution made you. No, wait a minute. I want to say, no, what happened here was really objectively wrong. It has nothing to do with evolution. This is really objectively wrong. You are objectively obligated not to do and to do certain things. And it has absolutely nothing to do with how evolution made you or how evolution makes us feel about certain things. Mm-hmm. That just won't cut it.
Right. Well, Dave, I want to wrap up here and give you the floor to give our audience, some of whom may be relatively unfamiliar or unconvinced that, philosophical arguments, have any merit or efficacy. I would like you to maybe in the last 10 minutes or so here to address some practical helps as to, maybe why, we've kind of gone through the why. For the layperson that is just sort of hearing this for the first time, maybe intrigued, certainly we want to get people interested in reading your book because I think it's wonderful. I mean, you don't have to know, you can really understand this book and not be familiar with everything. But for the practical Christian, church-going Christian who maybe has kids at college or, I don't need this or whatever, what are some practical tips in the way in which you can see philosophical arguments for God's existence practically applied in our Starbucks conversations or talking to people at the grocery store? How can we put this stuff into practice?
Well, let's think about this, first of all, for Christians. I think I've seen too often Christians who have, we use this phrase, lost their faith. I'm not quite sure what that means, but Christians who have certainly pulled away from a deep relationship with God. Some have actually become atheists. But for many, it's simply damaged their relationship with God because of certain events that have happened in their lives, maybe tragedies, maybe suffering themselves. And what has happened here is that I think our churches have all too often left us without any good teaching at this point. The only answer to these people often is, well, you just have to have faith. Believe harder. And I think that's a serious omission. This is precisely where these kinds of arguments should be helpful to us. We need to learn how to deal with the reality of evil, not just by affirming faith, but by understanding what's actually going on here and understanding how it doesn't provide evidence against the reality of God. And to do that, you'll need to understand a little bit, at least, about these arguments. These arguments are simply sort of common sense reasoning. We pointed that out a couple of times. This is just common sense understanding who God is and how God functions in the universe. And that, I think, will be extremely helpful to believers as we live in the real world. We don't have to live in the real world by blinding ourselves to what's really going on. We can understand it, and we can understand the role that God plays when evil occurs by understanding these arguments correctly. You know, there were a lot of people when 9/11 occurred. I heard people say, where was God on 9/11? There are a lot of people right now saying, where's God in COVID-19? How come? How come? And there are Christians who have lost their faith. They've lost their connection to the church. Oh, sure, they still believe in God and they're, you know, they still have that, but they've lost any reality in their Christian lives. And here's, I think, one place where the arguments play a really important role. I always tell my students, when you have doubts, when you're really troubled about what's happening in life, go back to the things you know. And the things that you know include your common sense reasons for the reality of God. They include the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. There are some things that you know. And when you have doubts about things out around the fringes, come back to the things you know. Don't just brush them away. I think these arguments can play a really important role for Christians.
And you see it in social media with skeptics who have popular YouTube channels, or because of the pandemic, everybody's kind of gone online, as you know. But a lot of the atheist videos and skeptic channels that are popular are regurgitating objections to these arguments that show forth a bankruptcy of knowledge about what is involved with these arguments. And it appeals to a generation that, as you say, kind of abandons their first principles. That doesn't make any sense to me anymore. That doesn't make any sense. This guy sitting in his bedroom talking about how God must be tested scientifically, that's appealing to me. And they're embracing arguments that have been soundly dealt with centuries ago. You know, I mean, there's still lingering debate professionally, but for the most part, the kind of simplicity that new atheism has brought to the foray has revealed a lack of depth in our own thought. And so people are going elsewhere to find, they think they're going elsewhere to find logic and reason and science and all of this stuff. Because I think for me, I see the church as having this kind of yard sale. We've had all this wonderfully rich vocabulary and we've just sold it. Here's a $5 word. Would you like to buy it? You know, and we've given away our vocabulary, to the secularists in some sense. I agree with that.
Yeah. I think we've sort of given over the playing field right now to atheists. This is really troubling, and it's certainly one of the reasons why I wrote the book.
Hmm.
There's an interesting quote at the beginning of Warren Buffett's autobiography where he says about Warren Buffett that he was too logical to believe in God. And I want to scream, no, he wasn't logical enough.
Yeah.
His problem was that he didn't think through these arguments carefully enough.
Mm.
And I think that's part of our problem. We've sort of, if you want a practical application, this is it. Not only are Christians damaging themselves by ignoring this, we're also damaging the whole culture because we've in essence given over leadership in this culture to the atheists. How many television programs are there where God plays any role at all?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's just sort of non-existent out there.
What would you say to our thoughtful skeptic friends who are intrigued by these things? What advice would you give them?
Well, maybe the most important thing is, please just go back and carefully look at the history of this discussion. Understand that all of your objections, all of these things that skeptics are saying, have been said a long time ago. I don't know of any real objections to God's existence that Aristotle didn't already answer. And we sort of pretend like these doubts and arguments are something new. I mean, granted, there are formulations of these objections that are new. Our science is a whole lot more sophisticated. But at base, all of these objections have been around for a long time. They've all been answered. Just be careful enough to really study the history of this debate and take a careful look at the philosophical arguments.
Dave, I thank you so much for your time, sir. It was an excellent book. I am still working through the ontological section, which I will leave for our readers to pick up the book and discover and work through on their own. It was the one section we didn't cover. But thank you so much, sir, for taking this time with us today. We appreciate it and delighted to have you. Thank you for the work that you're doing. This is a much needed book, I think, as Dr. Habermas's endorsement of your book says on the back, all under one cover, that we have all of these things. This is a great accessible compendium for lay people, for if you have grandkids in college, or if you yourself are just hearing a lot of these things for the first time. A lot of your skeptic friends and a lot of people leaving church, especially young people, are walking away from church because there's no meat, or at least they don't perceive there to be any. But we need to recapture for our youth, for ourselves, you know, the depths and the wonders and the richness and the wisdom and the knowledge of God that is contained in the wisdom of our ancients, of the patriarchs, of the people that have led the way and gone before us. So thank you again, Dr. Beck. And any final closing thoughts?
Well, I'm just grateful for being included in this conversation. And let me remind Christians out there, keep thinking. Worship God with your mind.
Well, thank you for taking the time to listen along with us today. We hope you've enjoyed it. As promised, we are offering our listeners free copies of David's new book, Does God Exist? A History of Answers to the Questions. We only have 5, however, so it will be first come, first serve. If you would like a copy, email me, Daniel Ray, at dray@watchman.org. That's D-Ray, R-A-Y, all together, the at symbol, followed by watchman.org. My email address can also be found in the description notes of this episode. I will notify the first 5 people who contact me with an address. Copies will go quickly, so act now. Apologetics Profile is a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information about our ministry, visit watchman.org today. That's watchman.org. To find out more about our Atheist and Christian Book Club, visit our website at atheistchristianbookclub.com. For Apologetics Profile, I'm Staff Apologist Daniel Ray.